The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to a special Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Keith Stewart and this week we're at the National Media Museum for the Bradford Animation Festival. This is the UK's biggest and longest running annual animation festival, which every year shows hundreds of animated films, and for the 6 year running has a dedicated video game strand. In this programme, we'll be talking to veteran game designer Charles Cecil, famous for the Broken Sword adventures, as well as the BBC's brilliant new Doctor Who games. We'll also welcome Kieran Gellin, once one of the most respected games journalists in the world, before he packed it all in to write comic books for Marvel and other people. And finally, we'll have Dan Pinchbeck, an experimental game developer and senior lecturer in games at Portsmouth University, where he specialises in the significance of narrative within computer games. It's video game narrative that we'll be looking at in the programme today. How far has storytelling come in game design over the last 30 years, and has it really come far enough? Are there lessons to be learned from animated movies and from the comic book industries, both of which have provided lots and lots and lots of inspiration to game developers? So keep listening as we consider all of this in the special Tech Weekly from the Bradford Animation Festival. Charles Cecil is founder of the British game studio Revolution, is one of the most respected adventure game designers in the industry. In the 90s, his Broken Sword games for the PC were cleverly and wittily exploiting things like Catholic cults, global conspiracies and Knights Templars years before Dan Brown became very rich doing so. More recently, he's been overseeing the BBC's brilliant Doctor Who adventure games, which I think this morning you've confirmed there's been about 1.8 million downloads.
Yep.
Be good actually to go back really to Broken Sword, I think, to talk to you about that. What do you think? I mean, Broken Sword has just come out on iPhone and iPad again, hasn't it? What's the lasting appeal of the Broken Sword games?
Well, first of all, thank you for a very generous introduction. I hope it's deserved. It might be worth actually going slightly further back from Broken Sword, because initially I started writing text adventures for the ZX81. So next year it would have been 30. My first game would have been 30 years ago. And Broken Sword came into existence because our publisher at the time, who was Virgin Interactive, really wanted something that was much greater production value. In those days, there was total emphasis was on the production values. So what they wanted us to do was apply the normal storytelling and the adventure puzzles, but to something that looked more impressive. So that was born in 1994.
What is it, though, about the way you told stories in that game, which still works? It's interesting that Broken Sword has come onto iPad at the same time that Monkey Island has come onto iPad and iPhone as well. And those two sort of games are quite similar in that they're point-and-click adventures with a very strong story, with lots of humour. What is it that those games represent that maybe the big blockbusting games now aren't doing with stories?
Okay, when I founded Revolution, it was very much in response to the games from Sierra, which took themselves incredibly seriously. And so, you know, some of you will remember the King's Quest games, which was King Graham of Daventry, who went around doing, you know, just exactly the sort of things that felt to me very cliched. Yeah. Thankfully, Monkey Island and the really big LucasArts games hadn't come out by the time I founded Revolution, because if they had, then I might well have actually gone and got a job with a publisher instead, or stayed with the publisher, because I was working for Activision at the time. So I think it's the sort of combination of the fact that the story is serious, but that there's humour. So certainly from the games that we've written, we've had certain rules. The first one is that we don't, I hope, patronise women. So we've always had strong female characters. We put a level of humour in. And we've generally recently put in historical references, because that then creates an authenticity, which hopefully, because it can be quite hard work playing through a game. And if you've got the humour and the authenticity, then hopefully you make it worthwhile and therefore that much more satisfying to play through the game.
And the Doctor Who games that you've done, how's it been to work on a game which has been so closely aligned with the television programme? I mean, has it been interesting, and how receptive were the production people on the television programme Doctor Who to you?
Okay, well, I've worked on quite a few films that have come across. And I guess I would say this anyway, wouldn't I? But it really has been brilliant, genuinely. Because, you know, right at the very beginning, I met with the writer and the producer, Stephen Moffat, and his team. And it was quite clear that they loved games. Everybody in that team loved games. So for them, this was really exciting. Often what happens is that you encounter these people and they see that the game is a money-making exercise. And it, actually, you're just a pain because, you know, we'll give you this material, but ultimately we want to get on with our own things, where there was genuine enthusiasm from that side. And the other thing that was really important is that there was sort of an equality as well. So, for example, you know, I had the privilege of directing Matt Smith and Karen Gillan, who were great, and they were genuinely really excited to see their avatars running around. There was, you know, huge enthusiasm. And also, there's a huge level of trust, so that in the games, we create new monsters, which obviously the BBC overlooked very carefully, but they were very happy for us to do so. And we had the opportunity to create Skaro, which is the home of the Daleks, and because the television series had never actually created anything apart from, you know, rocky areas with a little bit of mist to cover up the fact that there was nothing there, so we could create something much more sumptuous because it was a game. Yeah. And we've now, because it's very much part of the canon, this has now created Skaro definitively, so that if the BBC then want to do another Dalek episode and go to Skaro, they will use what we've done, because that is what it is.
Isn't there elements of the TARDIS that they since designed after you'd done stuff in the game on it, hadn't you?
Well, when I first met the head of the set design, he was very proud of the fact that the TARDIS was being changed. And we started talking about what you could do, how you could then go into new areas, how you would do that. And I turned up a month later and went round, and it was a lot more advanced. And there was the design as it is now, with stairs going off and doors. And I said, that's great, where do the doors go? And at that point, he looked at me in horror and said, but we put that in for the game. I hope you were going to tell us where they went. So, it's great fun.
This is a quite leading example of what everyone at the moment is calling transmedia entertainment, which is this kind of whole idea that TV and video games and the internet are converging into one kind of entertainment mush. Do you see this as kind of an important element going forward for games and for entertainment in general, this idea that everything's becoming interactive?
Clearly, the most important thing is to have a really strong idea. And that idea can sometimes translate and sometimes it can't. And if it can, then that's great. And, you know, Doctor Who, I think, translated fairly well. There was a lot that could come across, but there are plenty of other types of genre that just simply don't. Because ultimately, what games do very well is a character interacting with its environment. If you drive a story through interpersonal relations, then it's a lot harder for us, because ultimately we find it quite hard in games to create empathy. And there are many reasons for that, but other medias do it better than we do, which is one of the reasons why actually we license so many things across, because you bring the empathy and you can just go straight into the gameplay.
Is that a failure of games that they're not producing characters that you can empathise with?
I would say it's not. I would say that in games you have both plenty of opportunities and you also have constraints. And the opportunities, obviously, are the visceral ones, where you're going around, you know, visceral emotions, you're shooting, you're driving, whatever. But I'd like to think that we're actually pretty good at creating profound emotions as well. I think it's just harder to do. Because the thing about a film or television is that because you're passive rather than active, you're very happy to sit and you're going to give it time. So, you know, in film terms, you have what's called the inciting incident, and that's the incident that radically changes the life of the protagonist and the story is all about. And in a film, that could come in 20, 25 minutes into the, you know. But in a game, my view is that has to happen right at the very beginning, because ultimately you need to create the context within which you are controlling that character that is the protagonist. And because you have an associational relationship rather than necessarily an empathetic one, you've really got to establish the rules under which the gameplay is going to develop much, much, much earlier.
What's going on with Revolution Software at the moment? Do you have any projects that you can talk about?
Very much so. I mean, if we go back a couple of years, we self-published Beneath the Steel Sky, then Broken Sword. And there are several aspects that are very exciting. The first one is that by going directly to the audience, we build a direct relationship with the audience. And we can, you know, if somebody does have a problem and we respond quickly, they inevitably are very pleased because they're delighted that we come straight back to them. and we will bend over backwards to sort out any problems. And secondly, from a financial perspective, it also makes a huge difference. You know, we're effectively getting 10 times as much by selling directly. So it means that we can drive the price down. I feel very passionately that the games, wherever possible, should be a lot cheaper than they are.
So do you see anything interesting happening with...
Sorry, I didn't answer your question.
No.
Yes, we do have. We have three new games.
Okay.
We built a very good relationship with a comic book artist called Dave Gibbons, who wrote Watchmen. And in the early 90s, mid-90s, we wrote a game called Beneath the Steel Sky with him. Subsequently, we've teamed up with him again to help us on some of the graphics, some of the artwork for our new games, and we're now writing original games with him. I won't talk about what our new games are, but I will say that there are a number in development, and we go into a very, very exciting time from both a creative and a commercial perspective.
Okay. So we're looking at something much more, maybe along the lines of Beneath Steel Sky, something more science fiction based?
Oh, not necessarily at all. No.
Okay, and can you tell us when roughly we might be able to find out about your new projects?
Probably not for another year. Well, the smaller one in 6 months, the other two in about a year.
Okay, well, you're staying with us for the panel discussion, but for now, please show your thanks to Charles Cecil.
Thank you.
Okay, our next guests are both active in the world of video game narration. Kieran Gillen has just scripted The Curfew, a paranoid state surveillance thriller game for Channel 4's education department, and is well known for his diverse comic book writing, which has ranged from the pop music paean Phonogram to the axe-wielding action of Thor. And he's just started the X-Men...
Hammer-wielding.
And he's just started the X-Men spin-off Generation Hope, which I think the first issue came out last week, didn't it?
Yes.
Yep. Dan Pinchbeck is a lecturer on game narrative at Portsmouth University, as well as exploring experimental narrative games with his studio, The Chinese Room. So who better really to discuss the state of game stories amid a festival which is really about highly visual storytelling? We're just going to talk to you about what do you think of game storytelling at the moment? Where are we as a medium in terms of a narrative medium?
I think we're in a period of creative explosion at the moment in games, and I'm not sure how much longer it'll last. I think, as Charles was talking about earlier, direct distribution has opened the doors for a lot of smaller companies and individuals to get a lot more individual visions out into the marketplace. And they've been able to do that to a large extent because they've had that ability to directly go to the market, protected by the fact that they can't operate in the same sphere as bigger players. That's going to change because bigger players are going to start getting involved. And I think the thing which... I think the kind of like those of us who work at the more kind of experimental or indie fringe hope is that we can still reach our audiences. But I think it's going to be the same sort of thing. You know, the App Store becomes saturated, people move to somewhere else. Steam is going to become saturated over the next couple of years. New sites will arise. And I think we'll see a lot more of those kind of games move into much more kind of like forum community distribution models. But it does mean that actually I feel at the moment that we've seen some really quite phenomenal advances in game storytelling, really, compared to how quickly it's developed over the kind of the history of this recent bit of industry, you know, kind of from maybe sort of console era onwards, when I think it did kind of suddenly judder from what was quite sophisticated, quite interesting storytelling beforehand. I think we're really getting that back. And the other really interesting thing is that we're seeing a lot more risk-taking in story in much bigger titles, especially over the last couple of years.
Dan, can you give us any examples of interesting?
I'm going to ruin the end of Far Cry 2 for everyone that hasn't played it, but, you know, at the end of Far Cry 2, the Avatar has the choice to blow himself up to save civilians from being slaughtered in a civil war. That's a very unheroic heroism. That actually the fact that they've been wielding an AK-47 and mowing down people in their hundreds is suddenly thrown back in the player's face. And you're told that your actions that you've been doing for the last 20 hours are exactly responsible for the deaths of hundreds of civilians, and the only way you can kind of make good for your actions is to kill yourself. And that's quite a sophisticated political thing to put into a game. You know, Heavy Rain made it in retail release, and in the first 20 minutes you play a father who loses both children. That's quite not something you'd expect to see sitting at sort of like 50 quid a disc in game alongside, you know, sort of remakes of Wolfenstein. So I think we have a tendency when we talk about stories and games to compare the worst of games with the best of other media. And if you look at TV shows which are popular, they're not the most narratively sophisticated, nuanced works of art. They tend to be very simple, very populist, not particularly subtle. And I think the other thing is that, you know, I'm playing Singularity at the moment. I don't want it to be sophisticated. I want to, you know, nuke kind of like undead, you know, sort of like evil Soviet villain hitmen people back into the Stone Age. Because it's just, it's a break from being serious. I'm serious all day.
Kieran, you've obviously straddled the worlds of writing about games, making games, and also writing comics. Have games taken anything more from comics apart from a very visual style of storytelling and also this awful phase we went through where everything was cell-shaded? Has there been anything, has anything more interesting come from comics, do you think?
In terms of actual direct, complete, 100% influence, very, very little. You know, the answer is not much. Games are much more like sculpture, for my money, than, you know. How comics has most influenced games, it's comics are idea generators. It's how it's a very, very easy way to create a visual imagination, the idea to play with an idea and make it very, very pure and powerful. Because comics are very good at actually showcasing individual visions. And what I find more interesting is the analogous stuff. Look at, say, the mod community. And the way that mod communities essentially use these very high quality tools to create something. Okay, they can create just another Counter-Strike clone, but they could also create DSF, and this is what most interests me in that sort of area. And now we actually do have a narrative underground.
Call of Duty and obviously Black Ops has just come out. I don't know if anyone's bought it yet, but Black Ops is it's very interesting in that it's incredibly cinematic, and all the Call of Duty games have been very cinematic in the way that they tell stories. In that a lot of what happens is it's incredibly linear, and the story happens on the outside of the grain. So it's story section, kill loads of people, story section, kill loads of people. It works magnificently well as a structure, but is narrative really aiding the game?
Publishers who fund that sort of game simply can't afford to take risks. And to support what these guys have just been saying, I mean, ultimately, one of the reasons why this indie scene is so exciting is specifically because without this huge amount of risk, actually, you can come up with new ideas. And, you know, when I wrote my first game, I wrote it myself in a few days. It cost nothing. When we did Lyra of the Temptress, it cost £20,000. So it had gone up by a factor of 10,000. So we look back at the era of the 80s, which were considered to be much more creative, where people could take risks. But part of that was because these things were so much cheaper to develop, and so therefore you didn't need to go for the obvious.
I think almost we should be surprised that the mainstream games do take as many risks as they do. Yes. You know, that's the thing. You know, they should maybe would be even more derivative. I mean, if we were being cynical.
Well, except the audiences really, really like innovation. Mm. But yes. They also like to get what. So if you don't innovate and somebody else does, then you're at a huge competitive disadvantage.
Well, Dan, can we talk about maybe some of the independent games which are taking risks? Because it's very easy to say indie games, that's where everything interesting is happening.
Well, it's not. I mean, an awful lot of indie games are dull as anything.
Exactly, yeah. It's like mainstream games,
it's like any other medium. I mean, any creative content you look at any point in time, probably the majority of it is dull.
So who
worthless.
Is taking the risks then, do you think?
I think there's people like Jason Rohrer is really interesting. I really like Robert Yang's work with the Radiator mods. I know he kind of splits people down the middle, but he's absolutely pursuing a vision, which is, you know, wonderful to see. I really like Terry Kavanagh's stuff. I know it's kind of, that shows the kind of the range stuff. It's so mainstream in a way what he's doing, but he just does it well. There are designers and studios of very, very, very large-scale games that I just have a vast amount of respect for that I think have done more interesting things in their games than the vast majority of people claiming to be on the experimental edge.
We've got Microsoft Kinect. Obviously, a lot of the 19 launch titles are basically flail your arms around for 2 hours, then get bored and put it away. But I wondered if there's a future, if you all think there's a future there for the narrative possibilities that things like Kinect and Move offer, because they both have cameras, they both have microphones. So there's a kind of the possibility for gamers to have a kind of direct, almost interpersonal relationship with games. Is that interesting? Is that technology interesting as a possible kind of narrative?
I think part of what we're trying to do is we're trying to find more subtle ways of investigating the feedback loop of action-reaction. Because if you're locked into player acts, system reacts, yet another action, and this shaping and steering of activity, but it's fundamentally based on do things, and it does things back. That's the biggest conceptual block to diversity and subtlety in story, because you need time to think and you need time to feel. And we're finding ways with different games. And I think stuff like the fact that we do have, like, the Doctor Who game is coming back, that the adventure game is kind of making a resurgence. These are games that bought the players space to think and feel. They weren't just on a treadmill of action. Yeah. I think it'll take a while with kind of Kinect and stuff, because unless it would be lovely to see a game, can you stay still for as long as you can, and the moment you move, you lose, which would be a lovely way of using that technology, and would give you all kinds of room to play with. But they're very much based around constant movement. And so I don't know. I think location-based stuff and GPS stuff is probably a more rich field at the moment.
I think we need to hold out slightly longer for the technology, because at the moment it's very much based around body movement rather than the more subtle hand movement and maybe the facial expressions.
Obviously, what happened with Medal of Honor, which is a video game which deals with a current conflict in Afghanistan, there's been a lot of criticism of that game. Liam Fox, obviously the Conservative MP, said it was disgusting that a game should depict the Taliban as a sort of a playable faction. Are we anywhere near the point where we get over that kind of generational barrier that comic books have got over, that it's okay for video games to talk about and to explore real world
issues? I'm always optimistic, as in on this thing, like most things. But it really is a case like old people will eventually die. And I think it's a case of just waiting until all old people die and then we'll be okay. What's important is to actually developers to stay brave and carry on fighting their corner. There's an element of caking and eating it in that way. I mean, you set a game in Afghanistan, it's a political act, and you have to admit that. The start of Assassin's Creed saying we don't mean to have any religion element to it. I'm like, dude, you're setting a game in the Crusades, you know. You have to embrace the fact you're dealing with something that is controversial.
Okay, we'll open it up to questions from the audience in a moment, but just before I do, I just wanted to ask each of the panellists, if there was one narrative-focused game that you could recommend to people listening to the podcast or here in the audience this evening, if there's one game that you could say, this is a good example of narrative at the moment in gaming, each of you, beginning with Charles, which game would you point out, say, you've got to play this?
Okay, obviously I'm not allowed to recommend any of my own.
You can do that if you want to. If you want to use this as a marketing forum, go ahead.
No, I won't. I wouldn't do anything nearly as cheap and nasty as that. Dan mentioned Heavy Rain. I think Heavy Rain has got some huge flaws, but it is an amazingly ambitious title. Very, very expensive. I don't know if there'll be any more. Big, big risk. I really, really... It could only have been done by Microsoft or Sony, because obviously it was used to then promote their own hardware. But I think intellectually it does a lot of interesting things, so I would recommend that.
Kieran?
I'm going to go for Digital, which is an indie game by Christine Love, which is set in 1989, which she's actually like 20, so it's basically kind of the year she was born. So it's actually also a period piece, and it's basically about the very first bulletin boards. And it's about someone logging onto a bullet board, and it's kind of a love story between this person you're exchanging messages with, and then they disappear. And the whole game is played basically going to message boards, reading message boards, hacking into places. So it's kind of like a cyberpunk thriller, but it's fundamentally about this love story. And it's really interesting. The period piece aspect's very interesting. It's quite short form. It's very touching. And a love story in games is always nice to see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if I quickly... I've just finished Dungeoneer Beautiful Escape, which I'm going to write about soon. But that's horrific and genuinely disturbing serial killer a game. And but it's also a love story as well. And it's one of the darker things I've played ever, I think.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Dan?
It might be a bit naff, but the game, I think, which has absolutely nailed the relationship between story and gameplay best in the last couple of years is Uncharted 2. I think it does exactly what it needs to do, and it doesn't do a single thing more. They just nailed it completely.
Okay. Excellent. Okay. Do we have any questions?
Hi, Matthew Dullington. Charles, you mentioned earlier the importance of tactility in gameplay, and I wondered, just to the panel as a whole, how do you see narration in games having to adapt as technology advances to place players more directly within the game world as themselves, rather than represented by the avatars that we currently have?
There's obviously two relationships that you have. You have the associational relationship, where you are that character, and obviously in a third-person shooter, it's very, very strong. And then you have the more empathetic one, which you'd have through an adventure game, because you're not even directly controlling, well, certainly the games that we write, you're not directly controlling, you're indirectly controlling. And it's really a balance between the two. And technology allows you to go in and, through the tactility, I think you can probably increase the level of empathy because you feel more like that character. But I'm not sure that one is better than the other. I think that you just have to you have to decide where you want to be on that scale. Tactility, I think, probably supports the empathetic side rather than the associational side. Tactility probably supports the empathetic side rather than the associational side.
Yeah, I think I would agree with all that. The second you put you in a context which is not your life, you no longer cease to be you as you know it. As in, by being you in a video game, that's a reinvention of who you are, because we're beings of context and social. And that's kind of like a way that games actually sort of talk to people, in the idea that you learn new things about yourself by having these quasi-simulated experiences. So I don't think that's a problem. I think that's an advantage, and I think people will just rise to the challenge.
I think people also come to media for a crafted experience written by, crafted by people that are specialists in their trade. And in the same way that if I pick up a novel, I don't want a blank space in a paragraph for me to fill in the description of the main character. I'm not always going to want to put myself in a game, because part of the enjoyment is seeing a well-sculpted avatar figure that engages and synchronises and is harmonious with the rest of the world that's presented. And I think in a similar way that I feel as someone who wears glasses about 3D TV, there are things technology can do which doesn't actually offer any advantage to media whatsoever, or certainly hasn't been proved to yet. I'm waiting. The jury's out on whether being able to put yourself more directly into a game will, for a narrative game experience, necessarily enhance that game experience.
Okay, anyone else with a question?
Paul Raymond from Leeds. I was just wondering, with the amount of effort being put in by publishers now to force the multiplayer side of games, and with it being the best way for them to monetize and make more out of their products, do you find that as a worry when it comes to narrative? And do you think that would be sidelined for publishers who are thinking we should devote this much time to narrative, or do you just put all our eggs in the multiplayer basket because that's what's going to make us the money at the end of the day?
Yes, I would be worried about that.
I think, if you're charging 40 quid for a game and it's a shooting game, you have to have the multiplayer. And it's a little bit like, certainly when we were writing adventures, we came under pressure to write multiplayer. This was about 5 or 6 years ago, because it was the buzzword. And before then, it was the dreadful interactive movie concept, And publishers get this idea in their head that this is what's got to happen. If you're charging £40, people expect a huge gameplay experience, and that is delivered through multiplayer. I don't see any reason why you shouldn't have the linear narrative and the multiplayer absolutely complementing each other.
I think the price thing as well comes down to tools. That a huge sum of money is invested in creating tools constantly. And actually, when you pay 40, 50 quid for a game, you're subsidising tool development, not content. The content, the amount, the sort of relationship between what you pay for and how much of it directly goes to content as opposed to tools is minuscule. There's no reason why you have to be working at the cutting edge technologically to be working at the cutting edge in terms of the experience you offer. And games are about crafted experiences. They're not about technology in that way. Multiplayer is a good way of making it feel like you're getting more for the tools that you pay for. And actually, kind of where I'm interested in stuff like the mod scene is where those tools then, when you actually take having to pay for tool development out of the equation, you can invest in content heavily. And it's part of the reason why I have a problem with game length. I've said before that for the average game on the shelf, you could whip about 5 or 6 hours out of it and you could only improve it. We need to get away from this model that game stories have to be 20 hours long. I pay £5 for a movie that lasts 90 minutes. I'm happy to pay £5 for a game that lasts 90 minutes.
But part of it was keeping the price at 40 quid, which was, that's what this industry has been built on. And so by being able to go directly and charge a lot less, that changes the whole thing.
Absolutely. And I think stuff like the UDK license deals, the Unity license deals, that really strip down the cost of development. It is a second raft of developers. It's not the major developers who will develop their own bespoke stuff. And we need them. We absolutely need them to push technology and to innovate in that direction. Don't get me wrong. But now we have access for developers who don't have that kind of budget, don't have those kind of team sizes, and they're just investing more or less in content because they can't afford to innovate massively in technology.
Karen.
If we can actually, speaking specifically about multiplayer space, this will be a much better question to ask in a year's time, I think, because after, say, Old Republic comes out and Guild Wars 2,
the question of actually can narrative really work in a MMO will probably be answered or not, or more importantly, whether the audience will be interested in that. Because, I've yet to play an MMO where anybody really wants to read the actual quest text, no matter how well it's written. So is there a fundamental conflict there? And that would one genre closed off then to, quote-unquote serious narrative.
There's a couple over here.
Jeffrey Madison from Leeds. I do agree that narrative is important these days in games, and it actually, adds to the gaming experience, like visually as well, if you connect it up. And because of the game structure these days, it seems to be more focused on narrative, and thus you get more immersed into the game. Do you think that could actually be slightly dangerous for people with, addictive personalities, easily impressionable people?
Taking for a second that I agree with you on that. Narratives then mean that you play for it once and you have narrative, and maybe you play a few more times. You don't get the case where somebody just sits and plays the same narrative game for the narrative. If they play it repeatedly, they're playing it for a different sort of reason. I think that's my take anyway.
Tanya Byron did a review a couple of years ago. And the whole industry was really receptive, because we're so fed up with idiots coming and making incredibly inaccurate statements about how negative video games are. And the industry as a whole was very receptive to the idea that just because you can't prove that there can be harmful effects on some people, that does not mean that there aren't. So as an industry, I know that we would very much embrace proper research into this and take it extremely seriously. Beyond that, I really don't. I don't know enough about it to comment, except to say that it would be great, and we would very much welcome proper research into this area.
I kind of feel like, as well, on that, I mean, games get a really, really bad rap. There are really, really big problems in the world, and game content is pretty mediocre compared to a lot of them. So some games have very, very offensive content. Yeah, sure, they do. So do a lot of films, so do a lot of books, so does a lot of society, so does a lot of politics. To blame a medium and hold a medium up as irresponsible for that on the basis that because it's interactive, it's somehow more damaging than medium which is less interactive. Well, life's pretty interactive. I just think if people are going to focus their attention on potentially harmful effects on society, games, it's a complete witch hunt. It's a distraction, a political distraction.
I think there's another couple at the front. Yep.
Hi, Kate Elling. Kieran, you touched earlier about MMOs and about whether narrative can actually kind of happen in an MMO. I was wondering if we can expand that to look futurewards to see what the future of narrative is in casual games, and in particular with the explosion of social gaming that we're seeing at the moment.
As a critic and a gamer, what most interests me about games narrative is kind of what's most unique to it, which is, I mentioned environment and moving through environment, but it's also the idea of meaning through mechanics. The idea that one of the unique way that games can get across a point or an idea is by setting up a simulation, and the simulation creates something. And I think if you're looking for narrative or more than just clicking in a social game, I'd be looking at the idea of making a game that fundamentally does something. Cow Clicker is a primitive and sort of simple example of how you can sort of play with non-traditional game interactions to create some of a meaning. And that's kind of that's not narrative, but it's the same sort of general area as in meaning other than just clicking. So that's the kind of thing I'm really looking at, how mechanics could add to games and how mechanics can be narrativised.
I find it interesting that social games haven't done more with narrative in a way, because it's such a shame that you have this enormously social medium in which, Facebook has so many stories on it. In everyone, everyone's wall is essentially a story. So why are we playing Farmville?
Maybe I'm being very rude about Farmville, but it really doesn't require. I mean, you can be watching the television, talking to somebody, and playing Farmville at the same time. If there was a narrative, then you really would have to focus on what was going on. Is that very controversial?
No, I think it's absolutely right. I think people go to games for different things, and social games require less effort in that way. It's hitting buttons, and that's why Cow Clicker works so well, because you don't have to think, you don't have to engage with the story. It's got the loosest of contexts to sort of hang a few pegs off, and apart from that, you just, you're tapping your foot, really.
We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, but thank you very much to Kieran Gillen, Dan Pinchbeck, and Charles Cecil. Thank you very much indeed. That's all for the Reach Tech Weekly. So thanks again to our guests, and thanks also to our audience here at the Bradford Animation Festival for joining us today. Next week, the programme will be back in the studio with Alex Kotowski, but a heads up, the Tech Weekly will soon be out on the road again, visiting Dublin. All the details on how to come and join us there are at the website guardian.co.uk/techweekly. In the meantime, you can see what's happened here at the festival at nationalmediamuseum.org.uk/BAF. I'm Keith Stewart. The programme was produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.